Onasa. So I'd like to return briefly just to add a few closing comments or additional comments to this balance of the five faculties, and starting with the intelligence and faith, and understanding these different modalities of faith, of appreciation, of aspiration, and then of belief. So there were references yesterday to karma. You believe it or you don't. And then why would you believe it? Well, you may believe it just because you're living in a culture where everybody believes it. Just like we believe in viruses and germs or bacteria. I doubt many of you have seen them. But who among us doesn't believe in viruses or bacteria? I do. But it's based on authority. I mean, I just assume other people actually know what I believe, and therefore I know by the power of their knowledge. Huh? But when it comes to karma, how? Well, by sustained study, by reflection, by meditation, it's possible that greater and greater confidence may arise in the individual, the Buddha himself, and then those many great adepts after him, who replicated his discoveries. That's the big thing. That's unusual in Buddhism. We don't find a whole bunch of replications of Jesus Christ in the Christian tradition. Like, here was the first one, but then in the 5th century we had another one and another one. I'm not saying there should be, but he was in a class by himself, right? In the general view, he was the one and only. Whereas in the Buddhist tradition, especially the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, the Buddha made these discoveries, but then they've been replicated by many, many, many times by arhats, and then again in the Buddhist, in the Mahayana tradition, by later Buddhas. But I'm citing somebody outside the Buddhist tradition who was not actually formally religious in any sense, although profoundly sympathetic, and that was William James. And there are two quotes here that I think really highlight from a secular perspective this balance of intelligence and faith, including the faith of belief. Okay, ready? These are two of my favorite quotes, so I hope you enjoy them as much as I do. So here's William James, and I'm sharing the notes with you as well as the sources if you'd like to kind of check out the context. But here, in terms of intelligence, okay, this balance between intelligence and faith, here's William James's insight. Where preferences are powerless to modify or produce things, faith is totally inappropriate. And that is, whatever you think about gravity or the inverse square law of gravity, it doesn't matter what you think. It just doesn't matter. You can think it's an inverse cube law, or you can think that it's linear, whatever you like, but it doesn't matter. It's an inverse square law. That's the breaks. And there are many other things like that. There are many other just aspects of reality that whatever you believe or don't believe, it doesn't matter. Something's true, right? And I would say, from my perspective, I've been looking into this for 45 years, the continuity of consciousness beyond death, the notion that there is an individual continuum prior to conception following death, is just one of those things. It doesn't matter what you believe. It just doesn't matter. Well, it matters in the sense it will have a big impact on you. But your beliefs or lack of beliefs have no influence whatsoever on what is true. Something is true, regardless of whether you know it or whether you've checked it out for yourself. And so from my perspective, this is a done deal. You know. And I've been looking into Western vision, Western primarily the materialistic. And the more I look into them, the more I just don't even want to refute them. I just start laughing. Because it just doesn't look like they even have anything to refute. They don't even have a scientific theory. They have a belief. So the wheels, the kind of the something has been changed, it's been turned around. Back in the time of Galileo, it was the church that had all the beliefs, but hardly any ways of empirically testing their beliefs. And Galileo came along with empirical evidence, and he just overturned one belief after another with empirical evidence. And now the Church of Scientific Materialism has a whole slew of beliefs. The greatest threat to this great ship of the Titanic of scientific materialism is the torpedo of contemplatives. Not philosophers. They never agree on anything anyway. And the scientists, as long as they're studying brain behavior, they're not going to make any headway. They haven't. They won't. If I were a scientific materialist, I'd be terrified of contemplatives. Because they have the torpedoes that sink the great big ship of this Titanic. Massive inertia with so much wealth and power and prestige, a scientific materialism. So I don't really care about debating this much anymore. It feels like the debate's already won. You know, Really, it's already won. You either recognize it or you don't. So that's my perspective. So he says, there are issues like that, and I think a lot of people would agree. It doesn't matter what you believe. Your belief has no effect on whether there's continuity of individual consciousness before and after death or not. Something's true. The materialists are, by and large, you know, totally convinced they're right, and I understand they do. They're wrong, but I understand they think they're right. But your belief has no influence on it. But that's faith. That's where intelligence comes in. If something is true, the more deeply you investigate it, the truer it should appear. That's a basic Buddhist principle. Whereas if some hypothesis is false, the more deeply you investigate it, the more false it will appear. That's a good principle, yeah? That's where intelligence comes in, right? To determine what is simply true, regardless of whatever you believe about it. But then William James adds, but for the class of facts that depend on personal preference, trust, or loyalty for actualization, his words are so beautifully chosen here. But for the class of facts that depend on personal preference, trust, or loyalty for actualization, he says, in quotes, faith is not only licit, that is appropriate, suitable, and pertinent, but essential and indispensable. The truth cannot become true till our faith has made them so. So there's some things that could be true, but if and only if people believe it. Right. When we look in the Israeli-Palestine, it's just conflict, it's been going for so long. Could be possible that somehow, maybe not in the near term, but could there be some long-term strategy they can actually find peace and coexist without hatred, without animosity, without violence? Is that possible? If you're sure it's not possible, you're right. And if you think it might be possible, you could be right. But it will not happen unless there are Palestinians and Israelis who believe it's possible. Doesn't matter what Americans and Russians think, we're outsiders. It's their business. Yeah? So there are some things that will not be true till your faith has made them so. Can you achieve shamatha? Can people like you, any of you, can people like you achieve shamatha? If you're quite sure not, you're quite certainly right. And you think you could, you might be right. Right? As His Holiness said, a situation becomes hopeless only when you lose hope. Right? So this is one of them. I just love that quote. The truth cannot become true till our faith has made them so. In other words, there's a possibility, and the possibility is true. There is a possibility. I asked Yang Tanabachi about this. Could modern Westerners, you know, with our way of life and so forth, could modern Westerners, not just one or two, but could modern Westerners, or moderners, Jeffrey and so forth, you're not a Westerner, but you're a moderner as much as anybody else, right? Singapore, very modern city, right? Doesn't matter whether it's Ulaanbaatar, Shanghai, Singapore, Brisbane, we're moderners, right? That's much more important than, you know, how far east or how far west is it. And so I asked him, you know, is it possible? For people, did he think, for people living in our lifestyle, moderners, to achieve shamatha, and thereby to gain direct knowing of past life, memories, and so forth? And he said, you'll have to see. Possible. So that was good. He didn't say, are you kidding? Or forget about it. Nor did he say, oh yeah, sure. You know, that would mean like all we have to do is wait, because Yang Tanabachi said it's going to happen. Oh good, well let's see who does it. Who does it, you know. So he put it right there. It was like I hit a tennis ball to him and he hit it right back. You know, ball's in your court. So there's one of my favorites. I really love that one. And you now have it, you know. That's really good. It's that intelligence, it is exactly that balance, isn't it, of intelligence and faith. And seeing where faith is licit, where it's pertinent, where it's relative, where faith has power. Yeah. And then this second one, it's a different source, but William James again. In what manner do we espouse and hold fast to visions? That's a cool question. And you recall our initial fourfold vision quest, right? What would truly make you happy, and so forth. Visions, the vision of achieving shamatha, vision of gaining realization of rikpa, and so on. In what manner do we espouse and hold fast to visions And then he answers the question. By thinking a conception might be true somewhere. Maybe it's true that there are individuals nowadays who've achieved shamatha in Tibet, India, maybe Brazil, or, you know, Germany, whatever. It might be true. How do you know? It could be true. It might be true. By thinking a conception, an idea, a possibility, might be true somewhere, it may be true even here and now. There might be somebody here who's achieved it. How do I? I said, what are you doing here? But it might be true even here and now. It is fit to be true. And it ought to be true. It must be true. It shall be true for me. How's that? The image that came to my mind was like a boxer in a ring. And looking at doubt, looking at uncertainty, looking at afflictive uncertainty. So, Jeffrey, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to be my afflictive doubt. Ready? Okay, so you're my afflictive doubt. And I say, it may be true. Even here and now, it's fit to be true. And it ought to be true. And it must be true. And it shall be true for me. Jeffrey's out. Knocked out. Right? It's a way to really pummel afflictive uncertainty into submission. I really dig that. Okay, that's yours. And then we have the other balance of enthusiasm and samadhi. Gyatso Rinpoche has been enormously helpful for me in this regard. We have in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, more than any other I've seen, such an emphasis on prayers of supplication, arousing motivation, motivation of renunciation, motivation of bodhicitta, taking refuge, reflecting upon the benefits of whether it's shamatha, realization of emptiness, bodhicitta, and so forth, reflecting on, all you Lumrim practitioners, you know how enormously big this is. Reflect upon the advantages. If you were to achieve it, what would be the benefits, right? Big time. And then guru yoga, and making supplications, receiving four empowerments, calling for blessings. And then imagining the guru indivisible from your yidam, that personal manifestation of the Buddha that touches your heart most deeply. Imagine the guru, the Buddha, coming and indivisibly merging with your own body and mind. That's arousing. All of that is to arouse motivation, enthusiasm, to receive blessing, to arouse faith, of course, as well. And so, as Gyatso Rinpoche told me very clearly when I was in a quite intensive six-month retreat many years ago, he said, do that before the session. All of that. Whether it's Lamrim meditation, the seven-phase devotion, the seven-part devotion that the Kamachame Rinpoche discussed, that we practiced yesterday morning. All of these, the guru yoga, the supplications, the aspirations, and all of that. Do that just before you enter into the practice. And then you just drop in. Then you just go into the practice. And you leave even your desire behind. Because the desire, by the very nature of desire, is the desire for something you don't have yet. Right? And so that takes you out of the present. It takes you into ego, it takes you into grasping, it takes you into hope and fear, and so forth and so on. So he said, but there's a balance for this. It's not just practice with no desire, then you wouldn't practice. You say, well, I would practice. You just told me you don't have any desire. So I'll just sit here and not desire anything. Except where I'm desiring to sit here, so I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do now. No, I'm actually stuck. I have no idea. Because he said, don't desire anything. That's silly. It's like a skater, like a skater who really pumps, 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 and then glides, right? You arouse the motivation, you arouse the energy, the vision, the aspiration, the enthusiasm, you call for blessings. And then you go into the practice and you just glide. Then you just slip in and you just do it. That's samadhi. That's just single-pointed, now I'm doing it and I'm not doing anything else. I'm not thinking about future benefits, I'm not hope, fear, I'm not desire or aversion. I've already thought about it, that this is meaningful, so I'm clear on that point. And now I'm not doing anything other than doing it. Boom. Samadhi. You come out of it, and then you may dedicate merit. Oh, in the future may this lead to this, and this, and this, and this. great, wonderful, marvelous prayers of dedication. Good, but when you're doing it, don't conflate the preparation or the conclusion with the main body, and the main body is just doing it. So when it comes to that, and now just focusing on shamatha, good friend of mine, I've known him for more than 40 years, named Losan Rabge. We were trained as monks together, then he studied Tibetan medicine extensively, then he got a PhD in psychology. He's now a research psychologist at UCLA, quite an interesting man. Old, very, very dear old friend. And years ago, we were at an international Tibetan medical conference in Washington, D.C. And he was speaking, I think, from his background, which was quite extensive in traditional Tibetan medicine. He studied with Dr. Yishidunta. It was like my father in Dharamsala. And speaking in a very gentle way, he's a gentle soul, but he really knows the West. He's lived in America now for many, many years. And he said, you know, all of you, speaking to Americans, but I think he's speaking to moderners as well, just everywhere, said, you know, you're all suffering from lung disorders. And lung disorders is nervous imbalances. I mean, you're all screwed up. You know, you're all really afflicted. You're suffering from nervous imbalances. Considering how sick you are, though, you're coping very well. You know. And I think, actually, he's quite literally right. It's not to say that everybody in Tibet prior to the invasion and the genocide, that they were all, you know, just like hobbits, just enjoying their hobbit land. It was, of course, not true. It was not a Shangri-La. No serious person believes that Shambhala, that Tibet was a Shangri-La. But it's also true. If, like Geshe Rabdin, for the first 19 years of his life, your major source of entertainment was playing your flute, and you're watching yaks all summer, and then it's less interesting in the winter, you're just not going to have a nervous system wired like ours. It's going to be wired differently. And that's for traditional people all over the world. It's just wired differently. For most of the history of the human species, according to modern science, about 200,000 years, our nervous systems were not really preparing us for the 20th century of just this massive, massive overload of stimulation, of this anxiety, of fight and flight, the adrenaline rush, you know, just living in a mode of tension. Living in downtown in Manhattan, I visited there like going to a zoo. You know, it's like, whoa, it's kind of nice to visit for a short time, but then I really want to get out kind of quickly. I know there are people who've born and raised there, and I consider them mutations. Not bad mutations. I mean, I consider them, I don't mean bad mutations. That's not deprecating. It's just like you've adapted to that environment. And that's quite amazing. Because I can't even imagine living in that until I'm maybe an Aryabodhisattva, then maybe I could handle it. But that degree of intensity, just the intensity, right? Some of you have lived in New York. It's intense. The city never sleeps, it's just on all the time. And nature is a little park in the center of the city, surrounded by tall buildings and insanity. You know, insanity of, you know, modernity, but kind of condensed. And so we're driven, we're overstimulated in every way, with work, with entertainment, with the pace of life, with the internet and everything else. And so for us living in modernity, it's like if we were tires on an automobile, we're all overinflated. And, you know, an overinflated tire, on the one hand, on the worst scenario, it's ready to pop. On the other hand, in the best-case scenario, it's a rough ride. Because the tire is so dense, so tight, that it doesn't give you any cushion from all the gravel and potholes beneath. So it's a rough ride, a lot of wear and tear, right? And so when it comes to shamatha, for those of you who are maybe still struggling with rumination, maybe it still comes up once in a while, and the wandering thoughts in between and during sessions, I really say for the likes of us, and back, frankly, this is true for a lot of Tibetans now, they've been infected by modernity, a lot of them, most of them, is the first agenda is to put a pin in the valve and let off some of that excess air. Just we're overinflated. We're just so pumped up. And that's considered to be a good thing. In athletics, okay guys, now let's pump yourself up. You're ready, okay. As we're all pumped up. We pump up for exams, we pump up for all kinds of stuff. Get yourself pumped up. Pumped up, we say. You know, to perform optimally. Totally pumped up. Crazy. Think you can achieve shamatha that way? Snap, crackle. Snap, crackle. That's what happens. Not shamatha. Snap, crackle. Rice crispy approach to shamatha. So the first thing is just relax. And keep on relaxing. And keep on relaxing. And go supine. And just keep on breathing out and breathing out. And then breathe out some more and breathe out some more. The big emphasis, just keep on breathing out. You know. And if every out breath, just keep on releasing until your body is just going totally like soft, 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 soft. Breathing out. Keep on releasing. That's the pen in the valve of your tire. Because this, you know, they speak of myoclonic jerks when the body just undergoes brief spasms. I was thinking, what came to mind in the meditation this morning is when we're sitting quietly, just trying to breathe in and out, we have these, what I would call conceptual spasms, conceptual myoclonic spasms of just, you know, the mind spouting off with this and that, anything. It's just kind of like, it's an involuntary conceptual spasm of thoughts coming up with no meaning, no purpose, no coherence, nothing constructive, just like we're having an epileptic seizure in the mind, you know. And so, relax. Just keep on releasing the energy that's manifesting in these conceptual spasms until finally it just kind of calms down, and not because you've been the stern parent bearing down and disciplining your mind, but you've been the loving parent that just comforts, soothes, releases, rocks, gentles, and that you might have some rest. And then, during the in-breath, if you find that you're kind of getting so relaxed that you're also losing clarity, that you're actually on the trajectory of falling asleep, then when the breath just flows in, when it's given, it just kind of flows in, then gently arouse, uplift your awareness, quietly, non-conceptually. But then doing that only for a short time because you're ready to relax again, even more deeply the next time. Just come releasing, releasing, releasing. So then you're discovering stillness in the absence of the tightness, the agitation, the grasping, hoping, fearing, and all of that. You're discovering that stillness is what's left over. When you release all that grasping. And that then can become your norm, your base camp, your default mode. When you're walking, you're sitting, you're standing. That when there's nothing to think about, you don't think about anything. Just like if there's nothing to talk about, don't talk. That's simple. Yeah. So, practical way. Onaso. Let's practice. It's by more and more deeply taking refuge that we can bring about an existential sense of ease, of relaxation, of fearlessness. You've taken refuge. You're safe. You can relax now. And it's by arousing bodhicitta that every breath becomes meaningful, every breath, another step on the road, on the path to your own awakening. It's with the Guru Yoga that your practice becomes infused with blessing, something you don't earn, something that simply arises by itself. We speak of the preliminary exercise of settling body, speech, and mind in the natural state. But as with preliminary practices, this is not something we simply do at the beginning and then we're finished with it. Thank goodness that's over. But as the Pinjin Rinpoche himself comments, I think later in the text, this is ongoing. Continue throughout the session. This deepening sense of ease, of stillness, of vigilance in the body. The ever-deepening sense of letting go all control, all influence over the flow of the respiration, breathing egolessly, simply being present as the body breathes in and breathes out. And sustaining that stillness of awareness, utterly at ease, still and clear. Which illuminates the space of the body. And remain cognitively engaged, but not cognitively fused. With the sensations throughout the body corresponding to the in and out breath. Throughout the session, now and then, introspectively check upon the body, especially the face, and especially the area around the eyes. See that they are soft, relaxed. See that the flow of respiration is effortlessly released, releasing the breath completely. Fully, fearlessly, with every out-breath. And then simply allowing without impeding the inflow of the next breath. And and sustaining this core sense of ease, of looseness, of relaxation. Whatever thoughts or memories come up, let them come up by themselves. Let them dissolve by themselves. And let's continue practicing in silence. So just a footnote on the earlier comments. For this issue of just this one piece within the grander vision of the path, what I like to call like the on-ramp to the great freeway of the Bodhisattva path. The on-ramp to actually be able to enter the path, the freeway to enlightenment. In shamatha, the mind has to be really superbly serviceable to sustain that level of bodhicitta, that level of insight, and so forth. The mind has to be really, really healthy. That's often overlooked. Really, very, very often overlooked. We bring all our neuroses into Vajrayana practice and Zen and Vipassana and so forth and so on, and kind of think that will somehow sort itself out. Whereas it's really shamatha that was designed to make the mind sane, relaxed, stable, clear. And so to raise the issue is, you know, is it really possible people as screwed up as we are, you know, conditioned by modernity, to achieve shamatha in this lifetime? If that's going to be a realistic belief, then it has to have some real strong, obviously, some basis in reality. The cause and conditions need to be there. Otherwise, we're just, you know, dreaming, fantasy. And so they're the outer causes, the inner causes. They're very, very clear, and they're extremely well based on an enormous amount of empirical evidence. What are the inner qualities you need, and what's the outer conducive environment you need? And so it's been now about 9 years since I've been leading people in long-term shamatha retreats, starting from the shamatha project itself in 2007. And over that period, generally about 30 people, 30 students of mine all over the world are devoting themselves right now and 5 years ago and 3 years ago, to full-time practice, with shamatha at least being a very central feature of what they're doing. And as I've been, you know, engaging with them, doing what I can to help from afar, there's one common denominator for pretty much all of them. None of them have a really conducive environment. Never have. Conducive environment means it's just designed to help you achieve shamatha. And you have not only the environment, it's safe, it's clean, the food and all of that, and you have no visa problems, no financial concerns. You can just sit down and do the work, you know, do the work at hand. But not just a place. Places, you know, quiet places and that hard to find. But then having the supports and this group energy of fellow contemplatives, you have some group energy there. When I was receiving Geshe Rabdin's life story, and especially when he got into the Madhyamaka after about 8-9 years of his training, that 4 years when they're training in Madhyamaka, I was just astounded when he told me kind of just what was their daily routine. And I just asked him, how could you do that? It seemed like they're hardly sleeping. They'd have debates that would start in the evening and go until dawn on a regular basis. And they're memorizing hundreds of pages, and they're studying, and they're receiving instruction. And I just thought, I asked him, how did you keep that pace up? I mean, it was just like, oh, it's much more intense than medical training in the West. I know that's very intense. This is more, you know. This is just like, I asked, and he said, well, everybody else was doing it. It wasn't literally true, and not all of the scholars at Sarachi College were as intense and absolutely dedicated to the training as he was. But he did have a lot of companions. Geshe Namantage was a companion, Geshe Zuppa was a companion, and there were many others. And there was that group energy. You kind of look around, everybody else is doing it. Well, I don't want to be a loser here. You know, carry on. So similarly, if you're in a contemplative observatory and you know the people around you are meditating 12 hours a day, and that's just normal, then if you start slacking off, you think, well, what am I doing here? Maybe they'll notice and kick me out, you know. So it just be kind of, so none of them had that, and none of them have been in an environment where they have the conducive landscape and the food and all of that, and the companions, and a teacher there, an experienced guide, to really be right there available for them. None of them had that. So right now, on this date, I'm in the center of my mandala, like everybody else. The most viable place for that seems to be about 5 kilometers from here. Marittima, Castellina Marittima, the little castle by the sea. Been blessed by Lama Zubin Rinpoche, Dr. Rinpoche, Kandula. Some really wonderful things stated about this. And one of the Tsongkhapa Institute people told me that when Lama Yeshe and Lama Zubin were here decades ago, looking for a place to start a center, they were told me this. I wasn't there. And Lama Yeshe was cruising through this area. He looked up on the hill there and said, that would be good. And he was pointing right to Castellina Marittima. right to that area. He said, that would be good. And there was no property there for sale. And so then he looked down the hill and saw this castle, and then the rest is history. But even he back then, 40 years, oh, that would be good. Because it's up on the sides of a mountain. It makes the view here look kind of shoddy. Like, oh, you're way down here. Why aren't you up there? So it could happen. We're waiting very patiently. Very, very patiently. Italian patience. Like really patient. To see whether they'll grant us the building permit. Because we have guaranteed we can purchase it. That's guaranteed. We have a memorandum of agreement. And the price is very, very, I mean, ridiculous. €150,000 for 5 hectares. Yeah. It's cheap because it's agriculturally zoned. As soon as we get that permit, it's going to be worth a lot more. But we already have an agreement with the owners who would love us to have it. That if we get the permit, that's the price, $150,000. It won't go up. It'll be worth much more then, but we're not going to sell it. We like to make it. And so, to my mind, that's the missing piece. And also, I'm just seeing a growing number of scientists right here in Europe, right just down the road in Pisa, for example, who'd really love to come and collaborate. Open-minded, interested, and would just like to learn. And so it seems quite ripe. So as you dedicate merit, as you bring forth the aspiration, in this, as Claudio pointed out some time ago, in the homeland of Galileo. Because he's raised in this area, he went to the University of Pisa, he taught at the University of Padua, you know. He was an extroverted contemplative, that's what he was. I'm serious. He was trained as a contemplative in a famous monastery. What's it called? Just up Condoleezza, something like that? That's a very famous Christian contemplative monastery, very well known, only about an hour and a half from here. And he went there when he was a youth. He went there to be trained as a contemplative. He loved it. He wanted to spend the rest of his life as a contemplative. And it's still operating. It's a magnificent place. I can't quite remember the name, but it's easy to find. And his dad wouldn't pay for it because somebody had to be a sponsor, and his dad said, no, get a job. Become a doctor. So he went to University of Pisa and started studying medicine. He hated it. And then he found he was good at something else, though, and that was mathematics. And then and history. But he's an extroverted contemplative. That's what he was. Because he was seeking, since he wasn't allowed to stay in the monastery and seek the mind of God within, which is the classic tradition, within Christianity, within Neoplatonic Christianity, you go within. Well, his father wouldn't support it. Nobody else would. So then he, as in his own words, sought to understand the mind of the Creator by way of the creation, inferentially. That's another route. Right? Well, it turned out pretty well in many respects. I mean, that's science, the God's eye view, the God's eye view. It's worked out very well hedonically. Hasn't given us much of anything, eudaimonically. But then why should we have to choose? Why not have both? The hedonic in the service of eudaimonic, everything is in order. Yeah? We just need a little castle by the sea. Enjoy your day. See you later.